Welcome to a special edition of the Spectator podcast on the future of infrastructure, the challenges and opportunities ahead. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sir John Armitt, who's the chair of the National Infrastructure Committee, by Christian Womer, a Spectator writer who's just finished a book about Crossrail, and by David Barwell, who's the chief executive of AECOM, who are kindly sponsoring this podcast. Welcome all. Now, it's always a bit of a mystery to outsiders why Brits have a problem with infrastructure. I'd like to start the discussion by referring to a conversation I had recently. I was in a plane going to Sweden, and the plane was delayed, as tends to happen in Heathrow. And the Swede next to me says, "Do you know why this has happened? You guys haven't spent a penny on infrastructure for 30 years. Now, it was an exaggeration, but not much of one, because Britain, if you look at the G7, other international countries, we do tend to spend less on infrastructure, which is odd, given the links between that and our economic productivity. So what is going on? How good or bad are we? And so, John, I'd like to start with you. The National Infrastructure Commission is a relatively new organisation. Is it your job to try to stretch or make out like we're doing a lot more than we are? Because when you look at the amount of money being spent on transport, in 2010 we had something like 3.2% of GDP of the government was being spent on infrastructure. By the end of this decade, it's going to be something like 1.4%. So that is quite a decrease, the amount of government money going into infrastructure. So is your job trying to make little go a long way?
No, I don't think so. Our job primarily is to try and make sure that we identify what we need to do, and then government commits to doing it through ideally an approach which is more consensual with opposition parties. Because if you look at why we've not succeeded in the past, it's largely been because even within one government, one Secretary of State will say go and the next Secretary of State will say stop. Or then one party will say go and then the next party, when it comes into power, will say stop.
Any
examples?
We've
just never had... Well, Crossrail will be a typical example of stop-go, people, everybody believing it's the right thing to do, but nobody really having the courage to say, yes, let's do it, and then stick to a decision. The airports will be a classic example. Airport capacity in the southeast. We've been talking about airport expansion in the southeast for the last 30 or 40 years, probably longer, some people would say, 50 years. And yet we're still, we're still not 50-50 as to whether the third runway at Heathrow is actually going to go ahead. It's what many people would say politically was the likelihood of it.
Parliament's voted
ahead
for it. Are there any other obstacles?
Well, you've got to go through the whole planning process. You'll go through judicial review, which people are bringing. You've now got other developers suggesting that they can actually develop it more effectively than Heathrow itself can. And you've got the whole planning process to go through it before you. You won't start work there before 2021, 2022 with a fair wind. In the meantime, Heathrow is operating at 95% capacity, which essentially means 100% plus, because it only requires the smallest thing to go wrong, and the chaos resorts fairly quickly.
Right. So after all the fuss we've had about Heathrow, you still, we all know that there are headwinds, but you still think it's 50-50 as to whether we'll get a third runway through this process?
Having been on the Airport Commission and having recommended it, I am bound to be slightly more optimistic. But
50-50 is optimistic.
More optimistic. I mean, there are those within, if you like, sort of political circles who would say they see it as no more than 50-50. And the trouble is, it would not probably require that much for a government to find an excuse to step back. Now, Heathrow themselves are the ones, there's no government money effectively involved in this. There will be some on the highways, but the airport itself is all privately financed. Heathrow longing to get on with it, and now will drive forward. But you can see that there's plenty of room for this to take a long time.
Christian Womer, is Heathrow Airport a kind of metaphor for the problems that the British government has with infrastructure? That there are so many political wrangles that even something that everybody thinks needs to be done, in other words, more capacity in the southeast airports, ends up taking decades. Are we blighted politically?
But that's the problem. I think Heathrow is a particularly difficult issue because the southeast is very crowded, there isn't much space for expansion, and there's by no means a unanimity over the fact that we need it. You know, there's a big debate about whether we should cater for more air flights, whether the environmental damage is worth it. And indeed, I'm sceptical about it, because my view is that one of the main users is apparently going to be EasyJet. So all it's going to do is facilitate extra people going on holiday to Mallorca and make it a bit easier for them. So, you know, I think it's not a good example. I think actually Crossrail is a better example, because Crossrail precisely met a need. There was an absolute clear need. You know, London was getting overcrowded in terms of its mainline stations in particular, the absolute desperate demand for more rail capacity in London. And even then, it took a one go where it failed in the early 90s and it collapsed, and then it took another go, and there was ultimately cross-party support for it, and it was pushed through. But that's an easier example, because I think Heathrow, HS2, other big projects you can think of, all much more controversial.
And David Barwell, is it the problem that we simply have run out, the government is running out of money, that when purse strings are tight, then you're always going to delay the longer term infrastructure spending, and we haven't quite worked out as a country how to get more private money into the infrastructure?
Well, I think to your last point, yeah, I think certainly there is an argument that we haven't worked out how to get enough private money into infrastructure. And to your point, just to start off, just about the overall UK, I've been overseas for quite a long time, travelling around different countries with AECOM. And the argument is actually quite similar in a lot of the countries that you go to about infrastructure, and complaining, is there enough and are we investing enough and the like. But I think with government identifying very clearly what are the outcomes that we're looking for from our infrastructure, be that through hospitals, schools, transportation and the like, and then looking at the overall plan about how can they be funded, you know, is that through the private purse or the public purse, and then engaging with all the different structures to bring finance in. I think certainly with the government at the moment, from what we've been exploring with, you know, a little project that we're doing, which is the Heathrow Southern Rail, which I'm on the board and we've invested in, which...
That will link Heathrow to Waterloo Station.
It'll link Heathrow to Waterloo Station, but and it links up from Staines down in the south. And it's not predicated, I will say, on a third runway or anything like that. It's just purely alternative surface access into Heathrow. The reason we went into that was to actually explore this question and see if we could find the answer. So we've gone knocking on the door. Mm-hmm. We've gone to government to say, here is a solution. In the language that we're sort of using, it's a bit of a no-brainer. It's a pathway, potential pathfinder type project, which is ready. We have potential capital. We've been talking to the various markets.
And imagine that the trains connecting cities to airports are the most lucrative kind of train projects in Britain.
Arguably, yes. I mean, this project provides some alternative routing in from places like Staines and Woking and the like, away from Waterloo into somewhere like Paddington. So it has an extra dimension to it. The way that we would be operating it, though, is that this for us would be a piece of infrastructure. There would be the rail operators would run their trains on it. The income stream for us is regulated through the Office of Road and Rail. So there's a sort of like a clearer sort of stream of income. And then it's the private sector, which is then to take on the risk of delivery.
No, but I mean, it's a great project, but I think it suffers from a particularly British disease, which is you've come up with this idea, but the government is then unable to say, oh, yes, you must definitely do that. It's a great idea. Private sector is going to pay for it. The government instead responds by saying, oh, is there any other ideas out there?
Yeah.
We have to have competition about this.
Yeah.
And so your idea might not actually be the best one. We have to kind of open it up. I think that's one of the obstacles to private investment, is that you come up with ideas and then they can sort of get nicked by other people, rather than saying, that's a great idea, go ahead and do it.
So, John.
Thank you, Christian.
So, John, does the National Infrastructure Committee look at this question here? I mean, if you've got companies willing to build, you've got passengers wanting to avail themselves of the project, and yet it's the permission part in the middle which stops it. So, can your commission say, look, I think government, you should speed up this. Look at how they do it in other countries. They don't wait to 20 years for them consultations. You just simply have to make a decision.
Strictly speaking, that is not the Commission's role. The Commission's role is to identify strategically what is needed. Government then accepts that is needed. When it comes to the delivery, there's another body, which is called the Major Infrastructure Projects Body, which is another government body whose role is to ensure the most effective delivery of projects. Now, having said that, we are about to start off a piece of work at the NIC on regulation, which goes back straight into this whole debate about how much do things cost, how are they paid for, and what sort of structure does government have in place.
So you're looking at political logjams?
There are political logjams. I mean, at the end of the day, the customer pays. The only person who pays for any infrastructure is not the government, it's the public. And the public either pay for it through direct taxation or they pay for it at the point of use. And when people, for example, on the railways in the UK say, well, why are our rail fares so much more expensive than continental Europe? The simple answer is that in this country, there is a specific government policy which says the user will pay. The public should not pay for the railway. The people who travel on the railway should pay for it. Now, that's been a significant shift in policy over the last 15, 20 years, started by Labour, followed on by the Conservatives.
So but the government is still subsidising the train operating companies to a fairly massive extent.
No, I wouldn't say so at all. I mean, the train operating companies, in fact, are limited in their profit that they can make, and anything over about 4% goes back to the government. So they subsidise the government with the excess revenue. It's only on those railways where, in fact, you can't make it pay that, in fact, the government has to step in with subsidy to the train operators.
Christian, how many train lines are profitable right now?
Well, quite a lot.
How many don't require subsidies?
Probably the great majority, probably about 15 out of the 20 franchises. It's only the rural franchises that require subsidy. The problem is it doesn't pay for the investment. So most of the subsidy is actually going into longer term investment.
But I'm trying to work out, if there were no support from the government, if there were no, either in the investment or for the operating fees, how many of them could actually work?
Very few, if there wasn't support for investment. Mm-hmm. I mean, take London Bridge, for example. You know, that isn't paid for by the train operating companies, it's paid for by Network Rail. And without that sort of improvement, you would have a very shabby service. So, you know, you can't actually run railways. Across the world, there's only probably two profitable railways, Japanese passenger railways and Indian freight. Those are probably the only ones that are directly, and American freight. Those are probably the only profitable railways in the world. Now, can I just pick out something you said that is interesting about the private sector involvement? We have very limited legislation in this country to allow the private sector to be involved. So we had special legislation for Crossrail to have some private sector money going in. But in other countries, particularly Hong Kong as an example, you can get private companies to invest in infrastructure and then they get a rate of return on the land that is then acquired as part of that infrastructure. That enables much more private sector involvement. In this country, we effectively rule that out or make it very, very difficult.
We do.
No, David, can you say a bit more about how we do make it difficult? Because if we can assume that, you know, and okay, look, Jeremy Corbyn might win the election and decide to borrow massive amounts of money and put it on infrastructure, right? That might happen. But if it doesn't happen, it's difficult to see public purse strings loosening very much over the next sort of 5 or 10 years. Therefore, finding better ways of getting private money will be the main way of expanding our infrastructure. So what do we need to do that we're not doing right now? I mean, is it, for example, that, I mean, Sir John mentioned all of the things, obstacles still facing Heathrow, that even now you're getting judicial reviews, you might get Parliament changing its mind. Is it the case that we've got too many people requiring their permission, that we've got too many JRs, that we have too many planning authorities for anything serious to happen?
I think quite possibly yes is the answer to that. And I think it comes down to, in my mind, about going back to an earlier point, which is really about having a very, very clear plans. And if you can have those plans which are politicised, then, you know, you're missing the terms that we're talking about and the jumping and the different chancellors coming in and making their own changes. So if there is a very, very clear plan, you can then get people to respond to those plans and private sector can then enter it. And what government can be doing to encourage that is to explain and put a process in place which allows, which makes it very clear to the private sector on which door to knock within government to say, we have ideas, we have proposals, and the government can assist to bring all the stakeholders together to help realise those projects. Because at the moment, it's still...
It's a bit of a labyrinth.
It's a bit of a labyrinth. And you know, to be, the term that we've been using is we're still unclear on which door to knock. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is documented, and Department of Transport has produced guidelines for market-led proposals, but it does all sorts of things with that. It still wants to influence the process around the competitiveness that Christian was talking about. So there are elements of that which certainly are complicated, which I think can be made very, very clear. But again, I do think, and I'm not advocating that it's all open for the private sector and the private sector has the overall, you know, can come up with this great panacea of pumping loads of money in, because I think that, you know, that's not right. And I think what it does come down to is being very, very clear. These are our objectives, you know, through as a country, and, you know, balancing of where the monies want to be put in healthcare, transport and the like, being very, very clear, and then inviting the private sector to input into that, either at a macro scale or even at a micro scale to invest.
What you've got to remember, though, is that it is only road and rail which is financed publicly. Energy, water, telecoms, which are three massive levels of investment, particularly energy, are privately financed.
Really?
It is only road and rail and flood defences. Flood defences is minute compared with road and rail, that are actually funded from the public purse. And if you say, why is that, and can you put private finance into that, very difficult, quite frankly. Because as long as you haven't got road pricing, then how does the private sector actually get its money back? It's only going to get it back by an agreement with government, where government is actually guaranteeing that it will pay for a certain level of road usage, and then if it recovers through the number of cars which drive down the road. And as long as you've got, in this country, very little private highways, and look at the problems that the M6 has had in that respect, motorists will go on the free option until the moment it bungs up, and then they'll go over to the private.
But take Swansea Bridge, that's been a...
Well, the bridges are easy. Bridges are easy because you've got a captive audience. Mm. So there's no problem in financing a bridge. I was chair of the Second Severn Crossing, and the day we took it over, we bumped the fares up massively on the old bridge before we'd even built the new one, because we had to start recovering the revenue. And the Second Severn Bridge, the government has now decided to make free. Big mistake, as far as I'm concerned. Who's going to pay for the maintenance? You've got everybody used for the last 20 years to paying a toll to go across the River Severn. And then you say, let's pull it. Why? For a short-term political gain, because that sounds good. The public will have forgotten about it very quickly, and you've lost a revenue stream for the next 50 years on a bridge which is going to get steadily older, steadily need more maintenance. Where's the money going to come from? Not from the people who use the bridge, where they could have actually kept a small... Didn't have to... They've taken the whole lot out. They could have kept £1 or £1.50 instead of the current £5. I mean, it's just crazy. And therefore, I think you've got to look at these, each one, either stands or falls. High Speed 1 was privately financed to a large extent, but then people got the revenue stream wrong and had to go back to the government to be bailed out because they could had been over-optimistic once again, and people are consistently over-optimistic on the railways, as we've seen on the East Coast, about the revenue
and
stream.
And HS2.
And HS2, I mean, could you finance HS2 privately? No, you couldn't.
No.
Not without certain government guarantees.
But that's because you can privatise HS2 privately, I put to you, because there's no way anybody's going to get a return on the investment.
There's no business model.
And Hong Kong is slightly different because the value of land in Hong Kong does provide you in a city which is totally strapped for land. Land has massive value. So unless you can operate in areas like Hong Kong or Singapore where you've got very high land values, it's quite difficult to recover the value of the land into the opportunity. So I think we have to recognise that fundamentally all we're talking about here is road and rail when it comes to public investment. It's about 50-50. So there's $30 billion a year that the government puts into road and rail, and there's about $30 billion a year which is going into the other sectors from the private sector. And there should be more private sector investment.
The private sector is still very involved in... the public sector is still very involved in energy
through
decisions.
Through policy terms. Absolutely.
And through, for example, setting guide prices for the amount of electricity, the price of electricity in 20 years' time. Yep. So it is very...
And it's just interfered even more in the last few days by putting in
a price cap.
Yes. We haven't mentioned HS2, which is... You had political parties agreeing on this, Andrew Adonis and then George George Osborne. And then you had lots of, you know, the CBI, lots of people saying, look, the business case for this doesn't stack up. This might be a great political vanity project. George Osborne might like to declare himself a builder. But when you look at how much it's going to cost and how much we're going to get back from it, it is difficult to make a business case. I mean, we said earlier that private companies wouldn't invest in it on that basis. But I wonder if the same discipline had been applied, might government have actually thought, hang on, do we really need to spend all this money having people get from one city to another, or rather effectively to London, a little bit quicker? Are there not better ways this money could be spent? And so, John, you were quoted recently saying it's going to take another £46 billion to make the most of HS2. That's on top of the £56 billion it's cost.
Not what I said.
Well, okay, but tell us what you were trying to get. It sounded like an awful lot of money.
What we were saying, and as the NIC we said, was that the government needed to recognise that there needed to be a £43 billion spend over the next 20 years in the major cities in this country to get the best possible public transport systems in those cities, and that in doing that, it would reap further benefit from HS2. Personally, I think HS2, I've always supported HS2. I support it because, and I've said this many, many, many times, is that you cannot continue to put string and sticky paste on a Victorian railway. Our mainline railways are still carrying their more and more transport on the foundations which were laid down by the Victorians. If you were to say what's the most reliable railway in this country, the most reliable railway in this country is High Speed 1. High Speed 1 because it's relatively new, and in fact it's been engineered to do what it
should
do.
It doesn't have many trains on it, actually.
It has a lot of domestic trains as well as international trains. It doesn't have freight.
They had to introduce the domestic trains because they couldn't run it.
There's nothing wrong with that because it's actually speeded up people's commuting times from Kent by 30 minutes, which is pretty well 50%. Mm-hmm. It's taken out of most people in Kent's opportunity to get into London. Tickets are more expensive, but it's full.
But the critics of HS2 would go along with your argument, Sir John. They're saying, yes, the Victorian railways need to be renewed, but is this really the most effective way of renewing them? It's going to help a relatively small number of lines. It won't address the other problem. There's been a little bit too much political consensus to the exclusion of outside organisations who are saying, you guys must be crazy. There are so many better ways of spending the money if you're going to borrow it.
The important thing in this country, and it's been said time and time again, HS2, is that is part of this is to even out the opportunity in this country between London and the South East and northern cities. You will find enormous support for HS2 the further away you get from the Chilterns. In the same way as there was always enormous support for High Speed 1, because people saw High Speed 1 continuing into High Speed 2 from the north of the country, loads of resistance in Kent, where it was passing through the rural aspects of Kent. High Speed 2, what we're talking about here is a 100-year project. This is a project which we're going to get the benefit of for 100 years. The same as we've just had benefit from the Victorian railways for 150 years.
You're talking about the completion schedule there. No.
what we do have to do is get better at making sure we deliver it in the most cost-effective way. And I think there are challenges for our industry, the engineering and construction industry, to deliver at a significantly lower cost per kilometre than we will do.
And I think with HS2, and I'll just put it out there, that potentially, you know, there are other opportunities in terms of the way private sector might engage. It was interesting, you know, John saying it is a 100-year project. I sort of see that as a 100-year corridor. It's a corridor connecting absolutely vitally the two cities of London and Birmingham. But what else can you do with those corridors? Private sector would be very interested in putting all sorts of things in those corridors.
And also a new town there or something?
Well, you could use it as a very modern high-technology utility corridor.
In what
putting
way?
Well,
putting cables, electric
putting,
cables,
putting cables down there for 5G. High speed internet, high voltage electricity. The way we're going to use electricity in the future, but also by having that type of technology in the corridor, future proof that corridor to potentially other forms of transportation which might occur over that time. I mean, how long will rail still be going? It's been going a long time, but it's still steel on steel. You know, is there other technologies out there potentially over time in this sort of time frame that we're talking about? And just keeping these corridors, because it's very hard, isn't it, every time we've talked about developing projects with the community. And as soon as we can't go around digging up the countryside every time we want to bring in some form of new technology. So let's use these corridors, putting it out there, let's use these corridors as longer-term corridors that could keep us going for more than 100 years.
Right. So, John, is this the idea of us likely to occur to politicians after they've already started HS2 and it'll be too late by the time they work out they should be putting...
Well, as the NIC, we've said that these corridors should be used particularly for fibre. Fibre is one of the most important new technologies which we're going to be laying down. Mm. There is one which there is a very strong level of government support. So I think by 2033, which everybody agrees is a sensible target, we will be 100% full fibre in this country, including the rural areas. And that full fibre in itself will enable 5G, which is essential for autonomous vehicles, which is sort of the next step further down the road. And using these transport corridors is blindingly obvious, quite frankly, and we should be doing it, and we should take the opportunity to put whatever we can down these corridors when we open them up. Because as David says, every time you open up a corridor, you'll get lots of resistance, so therefore maximise the opportunity in any single in any single corridor.
Interesting. And you put the Heathrow expansion at 50-50. What would you say HS2 is, chances of that actually happening?
Well, I think the interesting thing about HS2 is 450 MPs voted for it.
Sure. But would you say it's more likely to happen in Heathrow,
Phase one, I think, is certain. And I would be very, very surprised if HS2 gets knocked back. Mm. If it did, then I think, along with Heathrow, we are really saying to the rest of the world, you know, we're giving up. We're incapable of doing large-scale modern infrastructure. Crossrail is a great example in London of us achieving high-quality modern infrastructure, but we can't just do it in London. The point about Heathrow is that it is it's not about EasyJet, Christian. Heathrow Runway 3 is about Asia, and it's about us being connected to Asia. Heathrow is our main freight airport for the whole country. Every plane that takes passengers is actually taking freight in the belly hold. They're not freight planes, it goes with the passenger flights. And therefore, Heathrow is the most straightforward way in which we can increase capacity for the long haul, not for the short haul.
Can I just raise something about this generally and particularly HS2? I mean, the predicted bill for HS2 at the moment is 55 billion or whatever for the whole 240 miles of line. But there's lots of quite reliable assessments that this is very a great underestimate. It will probably cost something like 100. No, let me finish. 100 billion or conceivably more. And therein lies the problem. We're not very good at building infrastructure at any kind of reasonable cost. And the thing I ask you, John, really, is, you know, at what price does it become just unacceptable to spend that level of money? Because maybe it is worth it at 50 billion, but is it worth it at 100 billion?
The point is, I would make to that, Christian, is what we don't do in this country, and particularly on government projects we don't do it, whereas on private sector ones we do, is somebody says, I only have 55 billion. Now, clever engineers, will you go away and give me that output for 55 billion? Which is what the private sector would say, and in fact, the private sector does it all the time. Government allows itself to be dragged along, or a bit better, a bit better, a bit better, we've got this problem, we've got that problem, and intellectually finds itself able to accept excuses. The private sector wouldn't accept excuses, and I think we have to be much, much stronger on our budgetary control on these projects and be saying to the delivery agents, that's all I can afford. Now, give me that output from that railway for 55 billion and go away and deliver it.
David Barwell, do you think we need some private sector discipline on the commissioning of these projects, that politicians are inherently a soft touch?
I actually agree with John, and I do think, I mean, two important things in the outset of a large project. The operator has to be, the person that's actually going to operate the thing, has to be at the top table and clearly understand the project and be very clear on the operating requirements at the outset. And the deliverer needs to be at that top table as well. But all aspects of the deliverer. It's not just the civil engineer who puts down all the civil works too, and then the poor guy doing the fit out and the operations piece comes along and has to just see what he's been dealt with that. Everybody has to come to the table at the very beginning together. Government, private sector, and then all the key areas of the supply chain at the top table at the beginning of a project. Very clear requirements for each party.
Right. But so, John, isn't this just a problem with democracy? I mean, a friend of mine who works in the Foreign Office was saying that he thinks one of the best infrastructure commissioners in the world is Hezbollah, because when they want to go on and rebuild something, they just do it. They don't ask anybody's permission. They just do it. Now, I imagine the Chinese are also quite efficient. I imagine there's not that many judicial reviews lodged to stop the Chinese government doing what it wants. So are we just looking at the problems inevitable to a Western democracy?
I think to a large extent that is correct. Democracy is expensive in that sense. But we are prepared as a society to accept that.
And what democracy is to infrastructure?
We don't want a dictatorship. We do actually want people to have a say, and at the end of the day to arrive at a democratic...
But what countries do it better than us, Western developed countries?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. If you look at the time it takes to plan major projects in Europe, then actually Britain stands very well. If you look at the total time, then Britain, compared with France, compared with Germany, does pretty well. What the French have done, I think, quicker than we have in the last 20 years, is actually recognise the importance of the front-end consultation. And the French will spend 3 years talking to communities about choices before they actually put a line on the map. We've tended, particularly with HS2, to put the line on the map without any public consultation. 100 options were considered for HS2 in locked rooms, as it were. A lot of thought went into it. Department of Transport then says, we've got the right solution, that's it. And then everybody's surprised when they publish it, everybody says, well, hang on, you know, we weren't asked, we weren't consulted. We should have spent much more time consulting with the public and having an open debate, because at the end of the day, that's what you've got to have. This is for that we're building for the public. So from the beginning, we should engage with the public, talk to the public about the choices, and really be far more open than we have been in the past.
I suspect that there'd been an open debate about HS2.
We might not have built it.
We might not have built it at all, because I think that's precisely what went wrong. I mean, Lord Adonis suddenly decided, oh, we want HS2, set up an HS2 Limited, which is a government company, drew up a line on a map within a year and kind of plonked it down and started effectively preparation for it. There was no proper debate, and MPs have been kind of bulldozed into the idea that this is going to be great for the North South divide, which I could spend a lot of time kind of questioning, and we look like we're going to be landed with the wrong project, going to the wrong places with the wrong type of stations, operating at a much higher speed than it needs to and costing far more than it should do.
But maybe
apart
Christian,
from that,
any,
it's a good idea.
But maybe any improvement on the Victorian status quo was going to be messy, was going to have the defects that you mentioned. Maybe what you would want realistically was never going to come out of our political system.
Well, I mean, there's a big question about whether it's London to Birmingham and London to Manchester that really needs kind of extra capacity. My argument would be what we really should have done is HS3 in the north, build a infrastructure in the north of high-speed railways between all the major towns, east to west line, linking Newcastle, Hull, Liverpool, Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool, linking all those towns with high-speed trains going at 80, 90 miles an hour, electrified, regular intervals, and branding it Rail of the North. And actually, that would be far better economically and far cheaper than HS2.
David Barwell, do you think there is a north-south divide in infrastructure?
I think you've got to look at, I mean, each area, we all agree on a couple of things, don't we, that, you know, investment in infrastructure provides an economic return. Mm-hmm. What I am seeing since I've returned, I am seeing that, you know, government is now saying things like the investment in the south, so take TfL. TfL is having to essentially being self-funded. Moving forward over the coming years, there is investment moving into the north. I think we all agree that having a better connected country between the south and the north is a good thing, is an essential part of the country's economic development post-Brexit, all the rest of it, which is a whole other area we could probably move into. But I am seeing, you know, now the right sort of level in the conversation about having that, you know, connecting everybody up together. But I think, you know, with HS2, things like Northern Powerhouse Rail add to the advantage of HS2 if that comes along. So you've got it connected up the north, connected into the mainstream and the backbones of running into HS2. But I will just make the point earlier, is that we were discussing what Christian and John were saying, is that, you know, it does come down to this overall planning. You know, getting very, very, and I like the model with the French, and we were saying, you know, having very, very clear plans, engaging with the communities early on, having everybody very clear about what the objectives are nationwide with a nationwide infrastructure plan, and then engaging with people like the private sector and others about how to deliver on those.
Well, I guess, Sir John, it's your job to come up with these nationwide plans to try to bridge the gap over political and governmental.
And we have supported HS2. We believe HS2 as a commission is the right thing to do. Equally, we are very strong about HS3 and the connectivity across the northern cities, and we've recommended that to government. What we have said to government, though, is you government should not decide how best this should be configured. Let the North decide how best it should be configured. And that's what they are doing at the moment. That debate discussion is going on between the northern cities. And we've recently said and set a budget of £24 billion for the first phase of this to get the whole thing going. So I think I don't disagree at all about the need for HS3. But you can't just continue to say that the north-south should only be connected by a railway which was laid down by the private sector in 1850. For goodness sake, 200 years later, are we seriously going to be saying that our only...
More air routes? Do you want an Elon Musk-style vacuum tube?
But you're not going to get there very quickly. In the meantime, we should actually get on with what the rest of the world is doing. The rest of the world is investing in high-speed rail.
Come on, John.
And it doesn't have to be that high speed, but it does need to be reliable and it does need to be capacity building. And this is a capacity-building railway.
You've got the wrong priority because you should do HS3 long before. We don't need extra lines between north and south. You can take a train now and get to Manchester in 2 hours from London. It leads in 2 hours. It's a very efficient service.
You're starting it now and it won't be delivered until 2033. So it's going to be 2033 before you get HS2 and it'll be in the mid-2030s before you get HS3. The two can actually arrive at much the same time. We need to do both, and we need to recognise the importance of rail in the future, as the rest of the world does. Goodness sake, we've got 100 kilometres of new railway in this country. Spain's got 2,500 kilometres of high-speed railway. Spain's now got more than France. And if we're going to keep up and this country's going to be able to fight its corner economically, then we've got to invest on this scale.
But so, John, but there was a great political agreement behind Hinkley Point C, and that looks like being an incredibly bad deal for the taxpayer with energy prices to the consumer that were agreed, you know, before the current collapse in prices. Isn't that an example of planning gone wrong?
Well, it's the problem with getting a forecast for a nuclear power station 30 years out and the uncertainties in building a nuclear power station. £93 a kilowatt hour. The latest bids for offshore wind, £47 a kilowatt hour.
And we're committed to 93.
So, yeah, we are for 30
plus
years.
Plus inflation.
Now, so as the NIC, what we've just recommended to government is that we should stop the current programme of building up to 10 new nuclear power stations. We argue that only one should be built in addition to Hinkley to give that some degree of surety around that sort of baseload. But that given the steps and the technology which is taking place and given the success of solar and offshore wind, and indeed, if we can bring more onshore wind, we could be 80% reliant on renewable energy by 2050.
And these are
we don't
trends,
have to have a nuclear program.
Like the energy price coming down, this is something that nobody predicted. Yeah. Even
Britain is leading the
ago.
World in offshore wind. In fact, we've just opened
the biggest one in the world.
So your recommendation is what? That the government ought not to repeat...
We should not race ahead with a big nuclear program. We should only do, at the most, one more between now and 2025. We shouldn't order more than one more.
We should get out of Hinkley Point. Come on, John. We should actually get out of Hinkley Point.
It would cost us a fortune to get out of Hinkley Point.
Well, I mean, their contracts...
Might be worth it.
And we have got nuclear stations closing down. The renewables is dependent upon the advances in storage because there are the infrequencies of supply from wind and from solar, and we need to see the energy storage technologies developing as many people would argue they will do in the next 10 years, which is why we're saying, hold your horses, let's see how these technologies develop. We don't need to rush ahead with nuclear. We could actually put our future in the renewables hands, and I believe that is a better decision today than to do a lot more nuclear power stations.
Right, but could there be a situation where it is a net benefit to the public of cancelling Hinkley Point?
It's a private sector project. The government has given that assurance on the price. That price would... If that's the only nuclear power station at that price, it's not going to make that much difference in the overall cost to us of energy if we've got a lot of renewable coming in a lot cheaper.
Well, it's a private sector it's the consumers who are going to pay an exorbitant price for their electricity as a result of this. No, we should get out of it if we possibly could.
But politically, it's very difficult, Christian. It's financed by the French and the Chinese.
And the Chinese are not
going to
like
it. Pulling the plug on Chinese investment and French investment into the UK might not be our best decision.
You get them to invest in HS2 instead.
Wonderful. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.